I am so glad that we met Serban Marasini of Edward Jones Financial Advisors. Serban has been there for all of our life moments, always centered on us and where we want to go. He was instrumental in helping us live around the world, building our media company, and nurturing us as a true partner for the next stage of our lives. You know, there are 19,000 financial advisors serving over 7 million clients. But Serban treats us like we are the only one, and the one that really matters. If you want to contact Serban, call him today at 303-494-2310. Again, the number is 303-494-2310. You know that life is for the living. Why not partner for all of it with Edward Jones?
And welcome back to Success Made to Last. I'm Rick Tokini. This is our Author's Corner. And this show is brought to you by Edward Jones Financial Advisors, along with Heather Barnes Media. And our very special guest is author Tony O'Driscoll. His book is Everyday Superhero, How You Can Inspire Everyone and Create Real Change at Work. A little bit about Tony. I'll read part of this bio, and then I'll let Tony handle the rest. He's a professor, speaker, author, and advisor whose engaging message emphasizes that the key digital age differentiator is not technology, but people. Amen to that. Tony has spent the bulk of his professional and academic career at the nexus of business, innovation, technology, change, and learning. He is at Duke, and importantly, for you blue bloods that listen to this show from IBM, he spent part of his time at IBM and has been a founding member of what I think is one of the most significant organizations called the Global Services Strategy and Change. Tony, welcome to our show.
Thanks so much, Rick. Great to be here.
It's nice to have you on. Okay, so I want you to tell us the rest of your story in terms of career and some of those highlights that might also include your meeting and love of Mr. Stephen Covey.
Well, I think we'll have to go there first, Rick, because actually that was very early on in my career that I had the privilege of meeting Stephen Covey. I was working at Nortel at the time, Northern Telecom, which was a Canadian telecommunications equipment manufacturer. And of course, with the change in regulation, Judge Green, Nortel saw tremendous growth in North America when AT&T was divested and broken up. And so I had the opportunity at that time, I was working in leadership development, had the opportunity to go out to Utah to go through the whole training. And of course, as you well know, Stephen's whole philosophy was you want to bring the education into the organization and you want the people of the organization to kind of, you know, deliver it, because otherwise it doesn't ring true. It's not authentic. So I was one of the very first people who had the opportunity to go out there. And when we were out there, this was early on in Seven Habits, they had just developed a video around Synergize. And that video was about the island of Mauritius, which you probably recall that video from way back when. And I had the great fortune of having lived in Mauritius for 5 years as a child. And so we bonded over that. I was like, the video really essentially captures the notion of what we might today call diversity and inclusion. You know, you set up this, you set up this island with a million people with all different ethnicities, et cetera, et cetera. And you ask people, what do you think is going to happen? And they're like, civil war and unrest and so on and so forth. And then you hear all of the positive outcomes, like the level of literacy and there's never been conflict. And so we really bonded over that. And then since that time, I've just considered myself incredibly fortunate to have had the opportunity to run across things with him. And in fact, in class next week, when I kick off class, my first message, my first whole lecture is called Don't Worry. And that comes directly from Stephen, because Stephen said one of the most useless emotions is worry. You know, you're stuck here. You're worried about something in the past, or you're worried about something in the future, but that's encumbering you from actually getting at something. Go do something about it. Don't just kind of sit and fester and worry. So yeah, Stephen's had a great, great positive influence on my life, and I'm very fortunate for it, as I'm sure you are too.
Yeah. And I think that in your book, you can see the influence of great mentors in your life, in Everyday Superhero. And outside of you know, I guess we could call Stephen one of the greatest mentors of all time, and I've had others, but who are some of the other voices that have influenced you that manifested itself in this missive called Everyday Superhero?
Oh, I think I think anybody who's had any modicum of success, you know, is standing on the shoulders of others who have kind of propelled them forward. So there's many. One would be my original boss, if you want to call it boss. I would never call him a boss, but, you know, in the hierarchy of things, was Tim Dempsey. Mm-hmm. He was the head of organization development for Nortel. And right around the time I was having my first child, he was a little like Yoda, Rick. He used to speak a little like Yoda. He said, you know, Tony, parents who have kids who read a lot don't read a lot to them. They just read a lot. And I'm trying to unpack all this because I haven't had a child yet. But basically, the message is, it's how you behave, not what you say, that matters more than anything else. If you want a kid that reads mm-hmm. a lot, you don't just read to them at night. You demonstrate the behavior by reading a lot. And that message always stuck with me. But I think as you go through here, another one that kind of happened serendipitously for me, actually, when our editor decided that Everyday Superhero should be a graphic novel, was Joseph Campbell. I was definitely familiar with the hero's journey. I was familiar with the high level structure of it. But when I got very deeply involved in it during COVID to try to actually build a narrative, build Maybe's heroine's journey on that, I grew to really appreciate a lot more about his perspective on, you know, the hero's journey being essentially a mythological journey that has a set of predictable kind of patterns, and that can be also a model for how you think about dealing with tests, allies, and enemies, or the approach or the ordeal. That these are moments that kind of can crystallize for you, and depending on how you respond, back to Stephen Covey, stimulus and response in that context, you can have positive outcomes or negative outcomes. And I believe, as you do, that if we all live every day trying to figure out and ask ourselves, am I being the best version of myself at this moment or at this point? And those points could be a call to adventure or refusal to the call. By necessity, we kind of will end up moving in a positive direction. It's just that we have to be conscious about that as we move forward. Sorry.
That's right.
You're asking me to wax eloquent on mentors. I think it comes down to those core principles.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing that you just said. And it's almost as if, Tony, your stories that come out, your narratives, is a choir of voices. But it comes filtered through you now. And then when you're in class teaching or people read your book, they're getting the best of the best. And anytime anybody mentions Joseph Campbell, I have a meltdown because I'm a major fan of his work. Mm. And the older we get, isn't it for you that you may understand Joseph Campbell's whole process a whole lot clearer and how it should be coming through our everyday language?
Completely. So the kind of epiphany I had was, you know, once I am exposed to something that I didn't even know I didn't know, I call that the DKDK, then I become mm-hmm. insatiably curious. That's just one of my, I don't know if you want to call it a fault or a gift, but that tends to be it. And so I stumbled into Bill Moyer's set of interviews on PBS with Joseph Campbell, which to this day is still the most watched PBS series. And so, you know, I had read the books. I had kind of looked at the synthesis of okay, I'm going to tell a story about Maybe for Everyday Superhero, and I'm going to follow the recipe. But I hadn't actually steeped myself in conversation. And by the way, it's a privilege to be on this podcast, because I believe, as you do, that, you know, you learn more in conversation between people. And so I learned so much by dedicating the time to just, you know, listen to the conversation between Bill Moyers and Joseph Campbell. It's like just one epiphany after the other in terms of, oh, wow, that really does mirror life. And I think, you know, as we get a little older and we have a little bit more time for reflection, or maybe more experience to try to process and make sense of, I found that to be a really rewarding part of the work. It was also difficult because I'm trying to take academic research and the latest research, I'm trying to fit it into a Joseph Campbell narrative, and I'm trying to personify it through one person. So that was actually, the research part wasn't as difficult because I'm an academic. I understand what the research says and what current, you know, the current the current most up-to-date empirical view on things is. But the tricky part was fitting it into the narrative and then kind of distilling it down into more of a principle-based type of approach, or a very small shifts, behavioral shifts that you can make. That was the tricky piece for me.
Thanks for that commentary. I'm wondering about inside your brain, how you combine and tell a story that still can be statistically proven, yet move over to the soft side of things. And the reason I ask that is because I grew up in Procter & Gamble and PepsiCo, and it was kind of hard and fast in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I'm wondering how you approach this book from the standpoint of, have we softened in corporate America and become so in tune to the vulnerabilities of it? And it's almost like you're proud to say that we made mistakes and that we now understand diversity and blah, 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 blah. So how have you kind of merged all of that and infused all that together to produce this wonderful book?
That there's a fair amount there. So let me see if I can kind of net it out for you. So number one, I feel, and I know you've had a couple of other authors on talking about, you know, COVID and Ukraine and so on and so forth. I feel that this period of time since, you know, the last 30 months, let's call it, has been an existential period of liminality for many of us. In other words, we've kind of had to let go of what we know for whatever reason. And we're not yet quite sure what we're grabbing onto in terms of what we're emerging to become. And the one thing we do know is whatever emerges on the other side won't be what was there before. So in other words, this is what I define as liminality, not me, but many people define that as liminality. It's that you're in the fog. You're kind of in the fog at this point in time. And the interesting thing about COVID is that everybody was in the same existential fog. Everything from, you know, will this virus get me at home, to how's this going to impact my company, to nation states trying to figure out what are we going to do to take care of our people. And my sense is that, and this is coming from Fuqua and Duke University, why I'm proud to be part of the faculty there, is that we believe that organizations have to do more to become a force for good in the world, that institutions like government alone can't go it alone. And I think, you know, if you hadn't had the likes of GlaxoSmithKline and other institutions that really innovated at scale with new technology, we may not be where we are today in terms of having vaccines and so on and so forth. If we didn't have the kind of global infrastructure to deliver, right, and manufacture, we wouldn't be able to do it. So organizations, I think, have more responsibility to kind of redefine what the world's going to become than they had previously. Previously, you might have just limited it to shareholder value, so on and so forth. But I believe organizations have to step up and do more in conjunction with non-NGOs and governments. So if that's the case, then it doesn't stand to reason that the way we traditionally led or the way we traditionally managed organizations would hold. In other words, if we're moving to a new level, if you want to call it that, or new realm, it doesn't seem to make sense that if you think about it like the Russian dolls, it doesn't seem to make sense that the leadership system or the management system should hold if the actual purpose of the enterprise has expanded. And so that's kind of the motivation I had to try to understand what do we have to do more, better, and differently with our leadership system, and more, better, differently with the kind of resources and capabilities that organizations have, where they can manage, you know, around the world globally 24/7 efficiently, effectively leveraging technology. And how might we, design thinking question, reframe the role of organizations and of leadership to do so? And then I came across a very deep insight from Alison Rollins that talked about the tyranny of the tangible. That most organizations today tend to be over-rotated on structure, system, process. If we just get the right org structure, if we implement the right type of motivation system or technology system, if we implement the right kinds of processes, we will be successful on outcome variables that matter, like profitability, so on and so forth. The problem with that is, I believe most organizations have kind of put the tangible cart before the emotional horse. Because the truth is, as Charles Handy, another one of my favorite business philosophers, would say, is organizations are nothing without people. If you literally subtract, people from an organization, it's just an inert set of equipment, buildings, processes. People animate organizations. People make organizations stop or go. Larry Prusak, another great mentor of mine, father of knowledge management, who I had the great privilege of working with, says that. I mean, people make organizations stop or go. And then you start thinking about things like execution, Rick, right? Execution. We have to execute, right? Execution means one of two things. It means to kill or to do. Now, unfortunately, organizations fail to make the changes required to implement their strategies 70 to 80% of the time. What they aspire to do, what they hope to do, what they aspire to achieve through a strategy formulated with a consulting firm or by themselves through the vision of a leader, doesn't actually, it gets executed, but in the wrong way. It gets killed rather than getting executed. So the express strategy, what we hope to achieve, and the realized strategy, what we actually achieve, are always at odds with each other. And at the end of the day, if you really look closely at it, that's not because of structure. It's not because of technology. It's not because of system or process. It's because the people didn't believe. It's that the people didn't feel a part of the change, right? So I believe we need to put the emotional course, the experiences, beliefs, and behaviors of people up front. And if those happen, then the other stuff just ships with the freight, right? So it's kind of let's put this is why the framework is called people-centered transformation. Let's put people at the heart, and I do mean heart, not just head, but heart, of the transformation. And if you can do that, what you do is you unlock this magical power inside the organization, Rick. And it's called, the academic literature for it's called discretionary effort. Discretionary effort is what you'll do because you want to, not because you're told to. You feel a calling for it. There's meaning in it. You can't not do it because you believe in it so much. When Martin Luther King showed up that day, right, that fateful day, he didn't say, "I have a plan." He had a dream. And others could connect to that dream, and they could find meaning in that dream, which then animated them, which motivated them to actually, follow. And to me, that's the definition of leadership. Leadership is that you engender followership. That's the one requirement. In order for a leader to exist, they must have a follower. Now, you can have leaders who have bad ideologies and have followers as well. I'm not negating that. But at the end of the day, to me, there's one and only one requirement for leadership, and that's followership. Now, what kind of followership do you want? Do you want compliance-oriented followership, where people are scared of your position power and will do what you say because they fear retribution? Or do you want followership because there's a shared aspiration and you want to kind of open up the opportunity for others to apply their discretionary effort where they feel they have energy and capability so that you can all move forward together on a positive progression path? I believe the second is the kind we need, particularly in a world we're not sure what's emerging yet. We don't know the answer to what the form factor of the world will look like in the next 3 or 4 years. We know that organizations, companies can help. And yet we can't predict what's going to happen. So we need a little bit more sense making from a larger group of people who have a shared sense of purpose about the next day being better than the last or being the best version of myself. And if we can pull that off, structure, process, technology will fall in line naturally. If we do it the other way, by trying to impose structure, process, technology harder and not involving people, I feel that what we're seeing now with the quote unquote great resignation and the nihilism that kind of exists and why bother will only be exacerbated. And I just don't see that as being a positive outcome.
Yeah, neither do I. You've just blown us away with a great narrative there. And I've got at least 4 questions coming out of that, but we got to cut to a commercial and we want to advertise and promote your wonderful book. Tell our listeners where they can purchase Everyday Hero and possibly even get an autographed copy, which I know autographed copy books are important to you.
Absolutely. So Everyday Superhero is now available here in the United States on Amazon. So that's the place I would go first and foremost. I would recommend that you can get both, the digital copy and the physical copy. The physical copy, it is a graphic novel. So it's a cartoon. And most people have said to me, having the physical book, just, you can jot on it, you can interact with it, and so on and so forth. So I would recommend that. Obviously, in the digital world, we all like to have a digital copy. But if you look around my office, Rick, I read somewhere that just the other day, actually, it's like people who are surrounded by books they haven't even read yet just feel better. And I definitely subscribe to that. I could have been a librarian in another life. So Amazon would be the place. And one thing we've done in the past is through podcasts, if people wanted to, you know, submit something through you, I'd be happy to send you a couple of signed copies that you could forward on. Or Very if good. People would love to have a signed copy, they can reach out to me independently and I can send them one. Depends on what the demand would be on that, though. But I do have a number of books here. But I do recommend the physical copy if possible, just because it's made to be consumed in an hour. You know, it's a story. And then the research is in the back. For those of you who like the research, I've definitely, you know, provided the links to all the appropriate research.
Very good. Thank you for that. And we will be right back with our special guest, Tony O'Driscoll, right after this message from our sponsor.
Hello, I'm Heather Barnes, food and product photographer and storyteller behind the lens. Our Austin-based team is all about visual solutions. For your brand, it's essential for your product to be memorable and have stickiness. Our clients like Ghirardelli, Tiff's Treats, and Nautamu choose our photography to develop positive associations with their brand. They call our work inspiring because it moves consumers into a relationship with their company. And we can do the same for you. Learn more today at heatherbarnes.com. Focused on you, your story, and your success with memorable photography garnished with love.
And we are back with author Tony O'Driscoll. He's more than an author and more than a professor. He just, you need to re-listen, folks, to the last portion that we talked about, tyranny of the tangible. Hey, you mentioned, you threw out a word, over-rotated. What do you mean by over-rotated?
I think sometimes we tend to have an unconscious proclivity to go in one direction or the other, you know, in kind of the sciences, we talk a lot about path dependency. So the path you've been down previously, how would I say it, narrows your view on the art of the possible moving forward. So, you know, history mm-hmm. as prologue. I think when we hit a period of liminality like we just have, right, it's truly disruptive. And this is something I've been studying for years. My history is I worked at Nortel. And Nortel emerged as a result of the disruption of AT&T, the breaking up of AT&T because of antitrust. But then Nortel itself kind of fell prey to the tyranny of the marketplace because it got stuck in its own ways. And so I think over-rotation sometimes is an unconscious collusion, if you want to invoke Jeff Bellman, where we're not seeing the full landscape of possibility because our history is limiting our view. And I feel that now, more than any other time in history, we kind of need to elevate our gaze collectively and start to paint a positive progression path forward for humanity writ large. And organizations, mm-hmm. I believe, companies, have a more important role to play in that. We can't just foist that off on government and say, that's your problem, not my problem. I feel none of us is as smart as all of us, and it's going to take the capabilities of NGOs, institutional government, and organizations to kind of reframe the art of the possible and then kind of start to work our way collectively towards an outcome that's better for society at large. I do feel that's important.
Thank you for that. Have you seen the movie Midnight in Paris?
I have not.
Okay, I want you to watch it.
Okay.
Here's the 30-second version of it. There's a guy that Owen Wilson is in Paris, and he travels back in time every midnight, and he catches this coach, and he's put back into the golden age where he can sit down and talk to Ernest Hemingway and Gertrude Stein and all that. And I'm wondering, in the context of that, what would you want Stephen Covey and Joseph Campbell to tell you about your latest work, Everyday Superhero?
Well, what comes to me is, did I do you both justice? In other words, I have an interpretation of what I believe was at core in your aspiration, right, Stephen, or Joseph Campbell, who I didn't have the opportunity to meet. Did I maintain fidelity with that essence in what I aspire to do here? In other words, you know, we're all standing on the shoulders of giants, Rick. And that's where I was quite deliberate in my work, was to try to honor that. I would say with the Joseph Campbell side, I think it's very hard for the Stephen Covey stuff not to be coming through, because, I mean, I've lived it for a long time. It's not separate from my being, you know, Seven Habits. Not only did I teach it, right, but I've had the opportunity to live it and then be counseled around it during these points. With Joseph Campbell, I feel like I may not have fully met that narrative, because I was more using the hero's journey as a recipe for the book before I had the epiphany in watching the series with PBS. So I'm asking myself that question, have I really done that justice? But, you know, life is imperfect. So I could guarantee I gave it my best try. Let's put it that way.
Very good.
I heard a message yesterday, and it made me mad, and I wanted to carry it into this show today, that the message was labeling Generation Z as the generation that's anxious.
Mm.
And I thought, shame on us and marketers and anybody else who's labeling an entire generation as anxious. But let's say that that's semi-true,
mm-hmm.
and that you are about to go into a classroom and everyone in that classroom is anxious. And let's say that your targeted market for everyday superhero is a future filled with anxious people.
Mm-hmm.
What is your book going to say? What does your book say to them? So they can find their North Star.
Mm-hmm.
And be a little bit more centered and get off of this anxious dis-ease that they are either in or have been labeled.
Yeah. Right on again, in terms of, as a professor, that's my audience day in, day out. I do consulting on the side and work with companies and stuff, but, you know, my day to day is with kids. I mean, folks who are 30 years younger than me, and I've been doing it for a long time. So I would say on your, you know, I'm not a big fan of labeling, but I would say, had I been in a situation where when I was 18, 19 years of age and a pandemic hit and there was a lot of obfuscation in the media as to whether or not you may or may not die. You know, I think our generation, we lived in a very, very fortunate 70-year period, you know, post-World War II, Bretton Woods institutions, all of that kind of stuff, world peace kind of as a global agenda that we were trying to implement. And I'm not saying there's been plenty of conflict, but there hasn't been conflict at the, you know, nuclear level that Bretton Woods was put in place to try to stop. So we kind of had a little bit of an idyllic pocket of time where we could kind of, you know, think more about opportunity and so on and so forth. I think for these kids, and I think I would be the same, you know, just there's been some perturbations in the force field of the universe where they're kind of like, whoa, I'm having to ask these existential questions at a very young age, da, 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 right? At the same time, they're mm-hmm. very, very, very bright kids, obviously, coming to Duke, and they have aspirations. And so that's the side you want to cultivate. Again, it goes back to Stephen Covey. Worry is useless because it just paralyzes you. So do something. Find a true north, to your point. Find a North Star that kind of motivates you, that kind of pulls you, you know, it's kind of like a vocation. And then let me do everything I can to help you from a strategy perspective, a marketing perspective, consulting, the courses I teach, for you to kind of fulfill that aspiration and to unlock your discretionary effort. So I think it's one student at a time, and wait till the light comes on. And once that comes on, then it's really just shepherding. It's really just kind of, providing the kind of guidance for them to walk into the light that they find, you know, the most illuminating, most instructive for them.
Mm. Well said. Do you know why you're on today's show?
So that people might understand a little bit more about the person behind the book, per se. I have no, this may sound a little crazy, but the book was an opportunity for me to work with a colleague who I really respect, who has a fantastic gift in visualizing. And I always learn so much when doing it, and a publisher who said, let's take a chance. So I have no, what you call it, I have no necessary commercial expectations on the book, but I do feel that it's good work. And so if people say, well, if this dude, you know, seems to have some good thoughts, maybe the book is worth reading. I that would make me happy, because I feel there's some good stuff in there, and it's accessible. That was the key thing, was to try to make this gnarly, messy research accessible and practical, because I just feel it's hard to have anything more than the attention span of a ferret on two cappuccinos these days. And so, you know, what can we do? Try to net it out into a narrative, which is what Joseph Campbell would do, and try to, you know, base it on the best we know in research today. And that was my endeavor. But I think I'm here now because we both had the great benefit of spending time with Stephen Covey. And anytime I ever have the opportunity to meet with somebody who did, I always have a great conversation. So,
likewise, the real driving reason for having you on here today was because you were one of the few people that qualified from the standpoint of moving from success to significance.
Mm-hmm. Back to, Ken Blanchard.
Yep. It's Ken Blanchard, but it's a whole lot more. In our definition, it's somebody who has used the amalgamation of all their wisdom, their layered intelligence, and now they're netting out a story for the future. And I would bet, Tony, that 90% of my guests are all futurists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Somehow have parted their own Red Sea, and they see something out there in the future, and they're using all this combined voices throughout their lifetime, and you're able to articulate where we should be going futuristically without being soft. You know, yeah. So there's a definite message there, and it's you're also academically advanced. You make decisions based on facts and figures, and there's a little bit of subjectivity there, but you're literally out there. And my question for you today is, as a professor of the next generation, is there any way to speed up the process of going from success to significance with your students?
It's a great question. I think there's a couple of, if you want the cynical answer, I would share with you, because my doctorate is actually in adult learning theory. So there's only two things wrong with our education system today: what we teach and how we teach it. And so I think we do a lot of kind of the STEM stuff, the math stuff, which is absolutely critical. I am an engineer by training, and I understand, you know, building a bridge or building a boat, whatever. However, I kind of feel that those things are productive learning processes. There are things we figured out we know how to do. And the goal of training, and I do mean training in this kind, is through repetition, learn the craft. But the craft is compliance oriented. The craft is about, we figured out how to do it. It's teaching people how to do stuff we already know how to do and having them comply. That's what I would call productive learning. And that can be disseminated at scale through technology. That's easy to do. You know, you can build models of planets going around, or you can build models of buildings and see whether they collapse or not. Where I feel we have a huge gap in education, epistemologically speaking, is in what I call generative learning, figuring out stuff that none of us knows the answer to, and being able to embrace diversity of perspective from all the way from science to philosophy and everything in between, and being able to make sense of each other's heuristics, algorithms, frameworks, right? So that we can collectively find the next level of insight that allows us to, you know, reframe our current problems in a way where we can solve them without downstream negative consequences. And so I call that generative learning. And I feel that the college campus in the United States, in its physical format, is kind of engineered to create knowledge accidents. It's engineered for the philosopher to knock into the computer science, to bang into the anthropologist, and for them to come up with something new and unique. But it happens outside the classroom, accidentally on purpose, if you will. And I'm curious about how we might be more thoughtful and purposeful epistemologically in engineering knowledge accidents, as John Seely Brown used to do when he was at Xerox PARC. And so I feel that content might be king, but context is the kingdom. And I feel that particularly American university campus environments are a great melting pot milieu for generative learning, to figure out things we haven't quite sorted out yet, because we have such a concentration of difference of perspective. But what we then need is kind of respect, listening, all the things that Stephen taught us all those years ago, with a shared aspiration to make the world a better place tomorrow than it is today. And in so doing, for me to become the best version of myself moving forward. And if you can't do that at college campuses, where can we?
Amen to that. And Tony, I want to thank you for being on today's show. If I could do a podcast series with you, that would be fantastic, because you just said so much. And the last thing that I just love, content may be king, but context is the kingdom. Oh, yes. My God. That's fantastic. Boom. It was like talking to Stephen Covey again today. I just love it. Thank you so much. Tell our listeners one more time where they can purchase your fantastic book or books.
Everyday Superhero. It's now available here in the United States on Amazon. So please, if you enjoy this conversation, there's plenty more to unpack in the book. And Rick, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to meet with you and converse with you, and hope we do it again sometime.
Me too. It was our honor. That was Tony O'Driscoll, author of Everyday Superhero, How You Can Inspire Everyone and Create Real Change at Work. Thank you, Tony. That was tremendous. As we close out this show, remember what we always say, and that's while you're on your journey to success, remember to do something significant. Have a great week.